Well, surprisingly, despite the dark, troubled times we're living through, or maybe because of them, thrillers and suspense writing are enjoying huge popularity. And it's serendipitous for our featured writer tonight, who has produced a chilling debut, drawing on her legal background and her love of sailing. Rose Carlisle's The Girl in the Mirror is about a pair of beautiful, identical twins from a wealthy family consumed by envy and jealousy. Most of the action plays out on a luxurious yacht sailing between Thailand, the Seychelles and Australia. And Rose Carlisle joins me now from Auckland. Welcome to Nightlife, Rose.
It's lovely to be here, Indira.
Great to have you. Now, your book, The Girl in the Mirror, has more twists and turns in it than a pack of twisties.
Yeah, it was really fun coming up with the twists. And they also, I feel that they all fit together. They're not just in there for the sake of it.
Absolutely. As a reader, it keeps you on your toes, that's for sure. Now, this is your first novel, Rose, so how did you go about mapping out such a complex plot?
It was quite unusual, actually, because I came up with this plot with my sister. So we were having a conversation together, and we came up with the key plot points quite quickly in a conversation where, because we found that we both wanted to write a novel about twins, and we each had some ideas, but when we put them together, it was as though this whole was greater than the sum of the parts.
Okay. Is your sister a writer as well?
Yeah, we were both trying to write a novel at the time, and we were both feeling a little bit stuck because, you know, I think the first thing you learn when you try to write a novel is just how difficult it is. And we were considering whether to just trash them and start again, and which we did, and I think that was the right call, really, to just leave them behind. But I'm eternally grateful to Maddie that she, after we put our ideas together and realised that from two ideas we had created one story, that she was happy for me to write it and to stand by as my assistant and my editor and my reader and so on.
Isn't that fascinating, particularly because the story is about two sisters?
Yeah, and I mean, it's even about two sisters fighting over one thing that they kind of have to share because there's two of them. So it is an ironic thing that
yeah.
We were.
Well, good on your sister. I'm sure for the next book you'll do the same for her. And I wanted to ask, are you still lecturing, or is that being put on hold while you're writing?
So I have just quit my day job in June when I started to see that this book was going to get really huge, and I was, you know, if I'm ever going to get the second book finished, I just had to quit my day job. And it was quite a scary thing to do, of course, because with COVID we keep hearing about the economy contracting and the dole queues lengthening, but I just felt that I really had to back myself at this point in my life and give it a bash as a full-time writer and see how that works out.
Well, that was very daring of you, given that we all know how precarious a writer's life can be, and you were giving up. How long had you been working as a lecturer in the law?
I started practicing law at the age of 21. And I practiced for about 7 years, but by the time I had three children and one of them was quite unwell, it was becoming very difficult. She had some immune compromise issues after being born prematurely. So I was a stay-at-home mum for quite a long time, and then I got separated from my husband and got a full-time job at around the same time as I started writing this novel. So it was a very difficult time to start writing a novel, but it also somehow that just worked out for me, that my novel was something fun and something just for me. And I used to write early in the morning. So I only actually had the law job for about 3 years.
And I've also read that you completed a master's in creative writing and was then awarded a writer in residency at the Michael King Writers' Centre in Auckland. Is that also how this book emerged?
No, I didn't actually write this novel on the course at all. That was the first novel that I was writing that I was sort of starting to tear my hair out over.
Right.
In fact, the timing was quite serendipitous because I wrote my first novel on a course, I was meant to hand it in on the 1st of November 2017, and my sister and I came up with the idea for this, The Girl in the Mirror, 5 days beforehand. So
wow.
5 more days of having to keep working on a novel that no longer was my, you know, my great love. But I finished it in, and then about 2 days later just started writing The Girl in the Mirror and just went hell for leather to finish it as soon as I could because I was just absolutely in love with the idea.
Was your first book, Rose, also a thriller, or was it a, was this a departure from that first book?
My first book was a mystery but not really a thriller. It was, you know, it was a little bit stuck because, like, I mean, maybe some writers are more clued up before they start, but I just didn't really necessarily understand different genres all that well, and that's something I've come to understand as I've been writing, which is a little bit embarrassing. But
I'm sure that's how it happens. Did you have you always been interested in that sort of mystery thriller genre though?
I was interested in mysteries more than thrillers, I would say. I probably haven't read enough thrillers to try to write one. So if I had realised that was what I was doing, I might have gone off and researched by reading a few more before I started.
Wow. But
I'm naturally drawn to mysteries. I like literary fiction, but sometimes it annoys me that it doesn't have much of a plot or that it will finish with, oh, you just never find out the truth, you know, that kind of literary ambiguous ending. And I didn't want that. I wanted something that had a real plot and really clear, you know, the reader is really clear at the end about what's happened.
Okay, so there's a very interesting process you went through both in your personal life and also professionally before you, you know, completed this book, which explains a lot, I think, when the listeners will read it for themselves, why it is so interesting. It is just filled with so much personal and life story in there. And much of the action in your book, Rose, is set on a yacht, and a number of successful thrillers have been set on yachts. Film-wise, there's been Dead Calm, of course. Why did you select a yacht as a setting for your first book?
Well, because I was writing The Girl in the Mirror while also a single mother to no fewer than 4 teenagers.
Oh, wow.
I realised that I did not have time to research anything that I did not have personal knowledge of, so I needed to draw on my own life experience, which is probably why I made Iris a lawyer, because I had been a lawyer, so my main character was a lawyer, and I created that yacht journey from a journey that I myself had made with my then husband and our kids across the Indian Ocean. So when I describe Thailand and the Seychelles, and when I describe moments like jumping off a boat in the middle of the ocean, those are things that I've actually done, and I didn't need to do too much research to write that. I just needed to remember.
Wow. Well, tell us about that trip for you. I mean, that must have been quite an adventure, travelling with all the children as well.
Yeah, so the children were 9, 11 and 13 when we set out, and we actually took a year to do the trip. We did go a little further than in the novel. We ended up in South Africa, and of course we stopped in many different countries along the way, because for me, a big part of sailing is not so much the sailing itself as the destinations that you can reach, where you can go where other people can't go. So, for example, when we went to the Maldives, I've met people who've been there several times and not even realised that it's a Muslim country, because they only are allowed to go to certain islands that are called resort islands and that are very touristy, whereas we were able to go to the islands inhabited by the locals, where there's a very traditional Islamic way of life. And so you just get such a different impression of a country like that by being able to visit both the tourist spots and the normally prohibited spots.
Why did you and your husband set out on that journey? What did you want to experience?
I think we wanted the children to experience nature and experience the self-reliance that comes from being in the middle of the ocean with no police or ambulance to call if things go wrong. And I think we really achieved that as well. There were, I mean, it's not scary or dangerous. Most of the time, if anything, sailing can be a little bit boring. But it does require children to lend a hand with their family in a way that I think a lot of us in modern life have lost sight of, where it's so much easier to just call in paid help from outside of your family than to recruit your children to get you through a difficult situation or just to get you through the normal trials and tribulations of everyday life.
And how did your children cope with the experience?
They really grew up on that trip, I think. I mean, I've seen them do things like they would overhear us talking about the food that we needed to get for the next leg of the voyage. And next thing you know, because in some of these countries, you can't go to a supermarket. There isn't a supermarket. So, for example, in the Maldives, our 14-year-old son said he'd found someone who would sell us coconuts, and he went off in the dinghy to collect them. And he was gone for a couple of hours, and we could see that the dinghy was empty. And, of course, we were now stuck on our yacht with no dinghy, so we had no idea where he was. And when he came back with a huge stash of about 50 coconuts, because we were about to go to sea, he told us that he'd jumped on the back of some guy's motorbike and gone off to the other end of the island and climbed the coconut palms himself to cut down the coconuts. So, you know, sometimes it's better what you don't know, isn't it? But that kind of thing, I think he gained a lot of self-confidence from that.
Yeah. And do you still do a lot of sailing?
I have not. No, I don't own a boat anymore. So at the moment, I mean, I still swim just about every day, but the sailing is pretty much visited in my imagination.
Through the characters in your book.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was really fascinating for me in the book, because I've always been fascinated by identical twins, do you think most people hold that fascination?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's always fascinated me. And when I was writing The Girl in the Mirror, I thought that I was drawing on my sister and my lifelong wish that we had been identical twins, because in fact, we're very different. We look very different and we always had very different interests. And then long after we'd finished the book and had it accepted by Alan and Unwin, she mentioned one day that she would have hated to be a twin. I couldn't believe that we'd written this whole book about twins and talking about the relationship between Iris and Summer and comparing it with our own relationship. And I still had this fundamental error in terms of assuming that she shared my wish that we could have, you know, played tricks on people and swapped places like identical twins, when actually she didn't want that.
And why was she never drawn to the idea of being an identical twin?
She said that she didn't like the idea that every single milestone in your life, you know, your first day of school and your every single birthday, would have to be shared. So even though she quite liked the fun idea of you know, swapping lives or sharing clothes and so on, because we were seldom able to share clothes, you know, we always had different size feet and couldn't swap shoes or anything like that. There must have been a point where my feet got bigger than hers, but it must have happened very quickly because we never shared shoes. So she did like some of those ideas, but on the whole, she didn't want to share those milestones, and she liked having a part of her life that was just hers.
The other thing you explore too, Rose, is that, again, we have this idea that identical twins are just going to be so in sync with each other and so adore each other. And you explore the idea that that may not always be the case.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing about the twin relationship, isn't it? Because, I mean, I think one of the reasons we're fascinated with twins, even though most people are not a twin, is that we perceive them as a sort of extreme version of the relationship that we have with our own siblings, or maybe even with our cousins or friends. It seems to make the rivalry that much more intense, but also the friendship that much more intense. And it's been interesting to talk to various twins and parents of twins and realize that the relationship can go one of two ways. Some of them really almost function like a single whole, where they complement each other, and, you know, one might help the other with maths homework while the other one keeps the bedroom tidy. And then there are those that sort of go a little bit darker and a little bit more, a little bit more jealousy and rivalry in there.
And did you meet any of those types of twins?
Yeah, I mean, we've all met twins over our lives, and I think we all perhaps make assumptions about their relationships, but then when we ask, if you get to know someone really well and ask the deeper questions, then you might realise that not everything is always as it seems. I know I've got one friend who feels that the twin relationship is much closer on one side than it is on the other, or there's much more affection in one direction than in the other, which is an interesting dynamic. But probably I mean, every twin relationship is unique.
This is Nightlife on ABC Radio, and I'm chatting to New Zealand author Rose Carlisle about her debut thriller, The Girl in the Mirror. And we're talking about twins because two of the central characters are actually identical twins in this wealthy family. Rose, the other thing that I found fascinating too is that their names, the names of these twins, play on both of them. They're quite central to how they perceive themselves, how they think other people perceive them. And it then goes on to have all these other ramifications for what they wear and their behaviour and how they're treated. This is what they perceive. And one of the twins' middle name, you've used your own name, Rose. Now, why did you do that?
I was wondering when someone was going to ask me about that. It's taken a while. I think the reason is that I've noticed over my life how many times people say to me that they wish their name was Rose. Especially if they've got a different flower name, they often say, "Oh, but the rose is the best flower, and it's the best name." And so, I mean, there's not many things in my life where I've thought, "Oh, I've got the best of that." But I thought, well, I will put that in the book because I can imagine my main character Iris feeling that way and feeling that her flower is not as pretty and doesn't smell as beautiful as the rose. I mean, it's always used, isn't it, as the sort of symbol of the most beautiful, most perfect flower. So I guess that was why I used it, and I hoped that it wouldn't distract readers too much that it is my own name.
No, not at all. In fact, I didn't notice it until a couple of chapters into you keeping on referring to Rose. And I went, oh, that's right. That's actually Rose's, the author's name as well. So I found this interesting because you're now saying that you liked being called Rose. But in the book, it's not that clear, is it, that the character, you know, liked those associations?
Yeah, so I think Iris has a few problems with her name. The first is that she doesn't have a middle name, whereas her twin sister is Summer Rose. Because I've always noticed that people who don't have middle names feel a little bit hard done by. The second is that she knows that her sister, because Summer Rose was born first, was given the name that her mother had been planning for a very long time. And that she was then named as a sort of, on a whim of the moment, and the fact that some irises were in the hospital room where her mother was recovering from the birth. And I thought that sets up the sense nicely in a short anecdote early on in the novel that Iris feels as though they didn't know that they were having twins, and there wasn't really room for her in her family's life.
The other thing that's interesting, given the fact that you've, you know, told us about the history of how you and your sister, you know, came up with some of the concepts and then she supported you through the writing of this. Do you think that that is now going to be a relationship that you will keep on using? Are you writing another novel together?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, we're well through the second novel, and she has written a first draft of a novel which I have heard once. She's read it aloud to me, so that's the first stage in our editing process, is that we read the entire novel aloud to the other one, which is part of the huge fun of the process, that we get to actually spend a few days together just reading the novel to each other. It takes quite a long time, but it's really worth it in terms of when you listen to a story rather than reading it, you're focused on how the story unfolds and you're not distracted by small things like grammar or fixing up individual sentences. So yeah, I think it's an ongoing fruitful relationship.
And it's fascinating given the fact that your first published book was about twins, and now you've developed a relationship with your sister that sounds very symbiotic. And you know, can you define what she brings to the process that helps you?
It is ironic that after a childhood of wishing I had a twin and feeling that my sister was so different from me, that it's actually those differences that I think give us strength. Because I grew up reading literary fiction and I loved 19th century novels, and, you know, I forced my way through Les Miserables when I was 15. Yeah. And she read probably a lot more commercial fiction and she watched movies. And so we came at writing almost from opposite ends of the spectrum, and there's that tension between us in terms of I would tend to want to go off on a flight of fancy, and she would just write on my manuscript, "This is boring."
You'd only take that from a sister, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and I mean, it was fantastic that she wrote that. That was what I needed, was someone to, because if you take a manuscript and cross out all the boring bits, you end up with a manuscript that's not boring. So we really, I think we still have the very different perspectives on storytelling, and that's been incredibly valuable.
And have you heard about this before, two sisters writing a book like this together?
Yeah, well, I Googled. I mean, everyone knows about the Bronte sisters. Mm. That ended sadly for all of them, of course, although the books are amazing. Then I found Margaret Drabble and Antonia Byatt.
Ah.
Who don't get along and don't speak to each other. So I thought, well, we'll scrap that. There's also Liv Constantine, who is actually two sisters. So that's a pen name used by a pair of sisters.
I see. Interesting.
And of course, there's the Moriarty sisters. There are three of them. Although I don't think that they collaborate in the same way. I think they might read each other's manuscripts, but not do the sort of pre-manuscript brainstorming that Maddie and I do.
Okay. And so can you tell me what the second book you've both been working on together for you, is that another thriller?
It is another thriller, and it's set in Australia, but I'm not telling people too much more about it. Mm-hmm. It's under wraps at the moment.
When do you hope to have that out?
I'm aiming for next August, but actually I'm going through that terribly nervous phase where I have sent it to my publisher and I'm waiting to hear what they think of it.
So, yeah, the second book nerves.
Yeah, they even talk about second novel syndrome. It's like a disease where you're just in such a different position, because if your first novel gets rejected, then that's just normal and nobody expects any differently, and you don't even need to tell people because nobody even has paid attention to the fact that you were writing it. Whereas your second novel, the stakes feel a lot higher. So it is quite a scary time.
Yeah, there'll be a third and a fourth one too, I'm sure. You've really hit a fantastic style in your storytelling. That, again, I'm finding interesting, given that we are living in these dark, troubled times. Were you surprised about how well it's being received?
Well, I'm probably one of those unusual people who had read about pandemics and always thought that one was coming. I've almost been surprised it took so long. So when things went south in early 2020, I did actually think that this book might not get published. You know, I sort of imagined that the whole world might fall apart and book publishing might not happen for who knows how long. I had all sorts of dark thoughts. And so when things turned out to be, although very terrible, not as terrible as I thought, I actually felt relieved. I felt relieved when I saw other people beginning to take it seriously. And I never really felt sad for my book, not, you know, the fact that I couldn't travel and promote it and go on book tours and so on, because it just felt like much more was at stake than my book. You know, it's people's lives and people dying all over the world. So I just thought, well, it's just got to be what it is. And then it's actually turned out that one of the upsides for people who are locked down, and I mean I'm locked down for the second time at the moment, is that reading provides an escape. I feel as though it provides more of an escape than watching TV or movies, because when you read a book, you're really inside someone else's head, aren't you? You've really lived their life, and your own imagination seems to be more powerful than any TV screen and really transporting you to another country. So I think perhaps that's why it has been reasonably well received, because it does really take you, aside from the fact that it's got dark themes, it does take you to a beautiful world, beautiful countries and the beautiful ocean.
But we can't get to at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of lockdown, Rose, how's the second lockdown going for you in Auckland?
I think most people are relieved that we did lockdown so quickly and that we've continued to go hard and early. So at the moment, they say that it's probably only a 2-week lockdown, which is really quite manageable, I think. So it hasn't, I mean, I just think it's difficult for teenagers who just love to be out and about. You know, my daughter cried when she realised she couldn't go to school the next day. But fingers crossed that it's only 2 weeks.
Well, New Zealand has definitely fared much better and probably one of the best countries in the world. So good luck with the rest of your lockdown. And thank you so much for joining us on Nightlife. A terrific, terrific read, The Girl in the Mirror.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on the show.
Rose Carlisle joining us for the writers from Auckland, New Zealand, with her debut novel, The Thriller, The Girl in the Mirror, a fascinating, dark book about beautiful identical twins who are consumed by envy and jealousy. And it's set on a yacht and there's oceans and there's sailing. So it's a wonderful piece of escapism as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.